Hey, welcome to Breitbart News Daily. Thanks for being here. Another jam-packed show today. We talked to the new head of the RNC, Michael Whatley. We talked to Dr. Sebastian Gorka, because it's Thursday. He got fired from a board that President Trump appointed it to. So President Biden tried to fire him, and they can't actually fire him. It was great. So we talked to him, and then we talked to Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin. And I think all of those are going to be write-ups on Breitbart.com. So you can check out those interviews there when an article is written about them. So we're going to play for you here the John Carney interview we did. He's the Breitbart economics editor, of course, Breitbart Business Digest daily newsletter. Must subscribe to. It's fantastic. The best business newsletter, no question. I'm not just saying that because I work for Breitbart. It is John Carney is the best. He used to work for Wall Street Journal. He's just first class. And he's really one of the only business people out there who comes at it from our perspective. So that's really important, obviously. So we're going to play for you him. Let's play for our open. Oh, because I think the most important thing, not only the shipping stuff, but Truth Social and how Trump is now one of the richest people in the world. He's richer than he's ever been in his life. As the media is telling us he's so poor, he has to declare bankruptcy. This is great. So we talk about Truth Social a lot with John Carney. But let's start off with our opening segment. I had a whole thing planned. And then right before I went on, I found this new Quinnipiac poll. And that derailed everything, which was just fine because it set up the whole show where we asked this question about the normie. I got a tweet yesterday. They still call it a tweet. This gentleman said, Slater, I'm disappointed in you. Oof. Little manipulation right out in the front. Disappointed in you. Okay, Dad, what are you disappointed? I just heard you say on your show that you could, quote, see how red flag laws could make sense. We were talking to AWR Hawkins yesterday, and we got into a conversation about red flag laws and how that, of course, is... They say these red flag laws are one thing, and then look at what they've already done, how they've already changed, right? At first it was, well, if a family member says you're a threat, the government can come take your guns away. And then it was, well, your coworkers know you pretty well too, and your neighbors can, and it just goes on and on. Pretty soon anyone will be able to say you're a threat, right? We use the example, he has a big Trump flag. AWR's got a big Trump flag on a 25-foot flagpole in his front yard, and that's menacing. So he's a threat to me, and he's got to go. He's got to take his guns away from. So we're talking about that, and I said, I could see how a red flag law makes sense to someone, and this guy took great offense to that. He said, really? How does a law that simultaneously violates the 2nd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments of the Constitution make any sense to anyone? Like, oh, this is a very, very important point. Maybe there's a word I left out of my initial statement. From a normie's perspective, I could see how a normie could think that red flag laws are a solution to a problem or a good idea. He wrote back, even uninformed normies should know about due process. Where's the logic in taking someone's gun away before their day in court based on nothing more than someone else's word? It's like, oh, we need to have a conversation about normies. You give way, way too much credit to the average person who is not listening to SiriusXM Patriot Channel 125 at 5:08 in the morning Central Time. Normies, I don't think people understand this. A person who doesn't listen to politics, like just like walking around person. They couldn't tell you what the Second Amendment is, let alone explain due process. You think you want to walk up to a random person on the street and ask them what due process is? They're gonna be able to tell you. I bet if you ask 10 people on the street what the Second Amendment is, what do you think? I bet eight couldn't tell you. Man, maybe five or six would have no idea. and a couple would say, oh, like guns or something. It's something to do with guns. Like maybe, like, and that's like the first and second and the most known. Like no way anyone would be able to tell you any of the other eight at all. Not even close. So like I'm talking about a normal, listen, people get very upset at me at this, and I got to do a way better job of explaining this. I know this is my fault. People are not, I want to say something like people aren't smart. That's not it, but it's something like that. People are just, they're not, I don't know, help me with the word. They're not connected. They're not with it. They're not paying attention. They don't care. I'll give you an example. This is a Quinnipiac poll, just came out. They asked this question, what's the biggest issue facing the country? What's the biggest issue facing the country? And they broke it up into Republicans, Independents, and Democrats. Among Republicans, immigration, biggest issue, 52%, then the economy, 27%. Okay. Among Independents, number one issue, immigration, only 23%. So Republicans by far think immigration is the number one issue. Among Independents, 23% say immigration is still number one, but it's tied with the economy. The economy at 23% as well. Among Democrats, the number one issue among Democrats, number one issue is preserving democracy at 32%. Number two is climate change at 11%. And number three is gun violence at 11%. Preserving democracy. What are you talking about? For Democrats, the biggest issue facing the country, this isn't even like what's the most important thing about this election or so. This is even broader. Like the biggest issue facing this country is a thing that is completely undefinable, that no one who said that could define it if you put a gun to their head, and was just made up like 6 months ago. Like, I don't know, when was the first time anyone ever said preserving democracy is a thing even that's under threat? That like, what are you talking about? Like, they hate, it just means they hate Trump, right? That's all. It's preventing Trump from winning. That's what it is. But do you see how easily manipulated people are? Now, I left one out. Among Independents, the number one issue is immigration, then economy. It's both at 23%. The number three biggest issue for Independents is preserving democracy. No one can define what that is. So if you're on the left, putting Trump in jail, ending the Electoral College, stacking the Supreme Court, and banning voter ID, that would save democracy. Right? But do you see how completely undefinable that is? And it's the number one issue facing the country, preserving democracy. Anyone who tells you that, you have to push back on them. You have, oh, this just happened. Oh, I got, listen, I look for any excuse to play it. Oh no, where'd I put it? The guy, Pierre, sorry, I only have so much place in my brain. I cannot keep up with Canadian politics. But the guy, my favorite guy, Pierre. Yeah, you got it. All right. So this is my favorite clip. So let me just read this because I don't even know what they're talking about. Trudeau and his Liberal Party. I know as much about Canadian politics as most people walking around know about American politics. Trudeau and his Liberal Party have fallen to third place with 39 seats. In first place with a commanding 182 seat projected lead is Pierre Poilievre and his Conservative Party. Okay, it's good. So this is the Apple clip. It's 2 minutes. I'll play it. I'll play it on loop. I'll play it on loop forever. This is what you need to do when someone says, when your friend, colleague, family member says, "Oh, the biggest issue for me is preserving democracy." Okay, this is all you need to do. You don't need to be a jerk, but what you need to do is you need to run to the kitchen. Or run to the break room, grab an apple. Okay, so you go. You say, they say preserving democracy. You say, hold on 1 second. Hold on, hold that thought. I'll be right back. I gotta grab an apple. You run. You come back. You say, you take a bite, and you say, all right, let's chat.
On the topic, I mean, in terms of your sort of strategy currently, you're obviously taking the populist pathway.
What does that mean?
Well, appealing to people's more emotional levels, I would guess. I mean, certainly you tap very strong ideological language quite frequently.
Like what?
Left wing, you know, this and that, right wing, you know, I mean, it's that type of ideological thing.
I never really talk about left
but
or right.
Anyways, a lot
I
of
don't really believe in that.
Okay. A lot of people would say that you're simply taking a page out of the Donald Trump book.
Like, which people would say that?
Well, I'm sure a great many Canadians, but...
Like who?
I don't know who, but...
Well, you're the one who asked the question, so yeah. Wow, you must know somebody.
Okay. I'm sure there's some out there, but anyways, the point of this question is, I mean, why should Canadians trust you with their vote, given, you know, not just the sort of ideological inclination in terms of taking the page of Donald Trump's book, but
what are you
also
talking about? What page? Can you give me a page? Give me the page. You keep
in terms of turning things quite dramatically in terms of Trudeau and the left wing and all of this. I mean, you make quite a, you know, it's quite a play that you make on it. So I'm
not
just
sure.
Wondering.
I don't know what your question
is. Then forget that. Why should Canadians trust you with their vote?
Common sense. Okay. Common sense for a change. We're going to make common sense common in this country. We don't have any common sense in the current government. You know, the guy prints $600 billion, grows our money supply by 32% in 3 years. That's growing the money 8 times faster than the economy. No wonder we have the worst inflation in 4 decades. I'm going to cap spending, cut waste, so that we can balance the budget and bring down inflation and interest rates. You'll want to be able to pay your mortgage again. You want to be able to afford rent. Then you have to vote for Pierre Poilievre, because I'm the only one with a common sense plan that will bring back the buying power of your paycheck.
Okay, there you go. See how great that is. Okay. So what's your number one issue, Nancy? Preserving democracy. Nancy, what does that mean? Maybe that's even too rude. What do you mean? Just let it linger. Just let it linger. Don't save them. Let them figure it out. What do you mean? What do you mean, Nancy? What does that mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? What is democracy? What are you talking about? And like they got nothing. If I were to define, so someone called in, Michael from Tennessee called in and said, the word for a normie, or like a definition for a normie, is someone who's not engaged. That's probably right. If you have any other, like, what's a normie? What's a political normie? What do I mean by that? 866-95-PATRIOT if you have a good one. I'm going to go with Ephesians 4:14. It says, then we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning and craftiness of people in their deceitful scheming. I think in a secular sense, that's what that is. It's someone who is easily manipulated. That's what I put a normie. It's someone who is, and as I used to be this, you're just going with the flow, like whatever. And it's not even just political too, it's just everything. It's like, I eat the food they feed me. I watch the shows they feed me. I think the things I'm fed. I just, whatever. Like, I don't care. I wear the clothes that they say, that culture says I should wear. I just do whatever. I don't have any convictions about a thing that is right or wrong. I just, wherever the sheep are flocking, I will go as well. And if everyone says that preserving democracy is a thing that's important, then yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's my number one, preserving democracy, that's it. It's just no thought to it at all. That to me is, that's a normie. By the way, among the Democratic Party here, again, the top three issues, immigration wasn't even there. Number one is preserving democracy. Number two is climate change. What? And number three is gun violence. Immigration and the economy aren't even in the ballpark here. It's pretty good too. Anyway, so that's what I mean. So this guy's like, hey, Slater, you know, people, how could this make sense to you? How could red flag? That don't make sense to me. That makes sense to a normie. because they don't know anything that's going on. And listen, I don't want to be rude about this normie thing. I don't mean it disparagingly. Like, you know, it's been fun last couple of days. Let me take it back. This bridge collapse is horrific. But yesterday, well, it's been fun to talk to Oliver Lane about it. And then yesterday at the end of the show, we had Oliver Lane. And we were running out of time, and it was a major bummer because we had like three guys call in who were on ships. And they're like, oh yeah, I don't even know what the words were. I can't even make up in like a little comedy bit the big giant words they used about ships. One guy wrote me a note. He said that the engines of these ships are three stories tall. Can you believe that? So these guys are talking to me all about ships and starboard and all this stuff. And I have no clue what they're talking about. And that's what I'm a normie. I'm a normie when it comes to shipping. And I don't mind that feeling, but I'm very curious. Like, I want to talk to people who know about ships because I find that stimulating. It's like, oh, like, what do you mean? Like, tell me about these engines. Tell me what the diesel does, this diesel engine. I got all this stuff about diesel engines. People tell me what diesel engines do. Or, and it's like, oh, I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about at all, but I'm really curious about it. But people know as much about politics in the country they live in as I do about shipping containers or what, right? Which is nothing. I know nothing at all. But I'm curious and I want to know more about shipping. And I don't just make stuff up if I don't know. I'm not like, oh, I have a very strong position on ships. I'm just like, oh, I don't even know. What tell me about the ships. But people don't do that with politics. With politics, you may know nothing, or someone may know nothing, and they're just like, yeah, that. And they take like a they're like, oh yeah, I'm on that side, the preserving democracy team. Like, they take a hard stance on a team that you know nothing about just because it sounds good, as opposed to just saying, oh, I don't even know. I just don't know. I don't know about that actually. Talk to me. Help me. No one says that. We're so far past that. For people, it's, I don't know where that is, but no one can say, oh, I don't really know. 866. Anyway, I got on a tangent there. I had a bunch of things I wanted to talk about. We didn't really get to it. But preserving democracy. Literally 5 minutes ago, I saw that poll. I'm like, oh, that's. Let's go to Jesse. He's in Connecticut. What's going on, Jesse?
Hey, Slater, the point, what's happened here is the propaganda machine has succeeded in brainwashing the idiots, the uneducated, in that if Trump is elected, he's going to ruin democracy. And we got to be scared of that because they've succeeded.
Yeah. Yeah, they have. So how do they think Trump would ruin democracy?
Well, you know, they never explain that. It's just the words.
Yeah. So what? But seriously, what is it like? Oh, he'll stay president for another 4 years, or he'll. What are they afraid of exactly?
Mike, they're not. They are just a bunch of sheep that have been led down the road of democracy is going to go away if you vote for Trump. And boy. Look at what the results come out. They have succeeded.
They totally
scary
have.
Scary stuff. And like you say, people are just, they don't educate themselves to find out or ask the question, wait a minute, what is Trump doing that would destroy democracy? Nobody says it. Nobody looks at that.
Yeah. So what do you have any suggestion on how to combat this one other than my passive idea of just asking? Like, what do you mean?
Well, I keep saying that we should come back just like the Dems come back. Every time they come out with a lie, we should be really focusing in on, hey, there's nothing wrong with Trump destroying democracy. You guys have made all this crap up.
Yeah. Jesse, thanks for the call, man. That's it. I just bought this book. I left it downstairs. Let me read this first while I'm pulling up this book. Just Bob on Twitter said, a normie is someone who believes at face value and has no desire to question. And that's it. It's part of it too. Just like, oh yeah, sounds good. I'm in. Kid Dino says, a normie can also be explained by apathy. Same idea. Most people aren't interested in politics presuming it's all one long or boring C-SPAN episode. Yeah, I guess my rebuttal to that is you may not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. You know what I mean? You could probably go your whole life not knowing the details of a giant diesel shipping container. That's not a shipping container, a giant container ship. But you better know about politics because it's coming for you. So I just got this book. It's by Jeffrey Rosen. I don't know this guy. He's at the Constitution Center, president of the National Constitution Center. And he wrote this book called The Pursuit of Happiness. And I just read a couple pages of the intro. And it was in the beginning of COVID, the COVID lockdowns. He came across a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to, I don't know, someone. And it was like the top 10 most important books that in his political thinking. And I've never heard of any of them. Never heard of them. That's how pathetic our education system is today. I've never heard of these books. Let alone read them, of course. Let alone are they a part of our DNA still today. They're certainly not a part of like our conversation today. That's how far we are. It's amazing we're still afloat. Or are we? So this guy read them all. He read the books, all the top 10 books, and he's doing a review of them all and applying them to the different founders. And it's all, here's the subtitle is How Classical Writers on Virtue Inspired the Lives of the Founders and Defined America. And he makes the point straight up that the pursuit of happiness, that's the title of the book, The Pursuit of Happiness, means the practice of virtue, which is what we have talked about before on this show, obviously many times. Pursuit of happiness means the practice of virtue. So I'm going to read this book and we'll introduce all these themes here because that's it. Like that is our country. This is our founding fathers. The most important thing to them was practicing virtue. It is the point of this country. It is a place where people are free to practice their virtue. And then what does that mean? And they put pursuit there because the classic writers, and we have receipts, we can quote this, quote Cicero, quote these guys. It's something that can never be fully attained, but it's something that should be always striven for. You should always strive for it, even though you can never fully attain it. This perfection, this virtue, right? It's a sanctification process over the course of your life, and it's a beautiful thing. And we're not even close, not even close. But if you really want to save this country, which I do, I and we all need to get back to those, not only our founding principles from our founding fathers, but the guys who came before them, who inspired them, our founding grandfathers, and then go back into the classical writing, which is what our founders, of course, were immersed in. They lived in this soup that were the classics. Isn't that a wonderful thing? No one's even close to that. I'm not even close to that. You think your average walking around person has any idea about any of this stuff? No, of course not. They're an infant, tossed back and forth by the waves, blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning and craftiness of people in their deceitful scheming. Whatever they hear first that sounds good, boom, done. That's why in my book, How to Change Someone's Mind, which is right up there with Cicero and Aristotle and all the greats, the most important thing is where. If you want to try to change someone's mind, you have to find out, you and they have to find out where they got their opinion. Because most people, you know where they got their opinion? Do you know where most people got their opinion? They have no idea. And when you ask them, not what they think, they'll be quick to tell you that, but where that came from, most people will have no idea. And they'll realize for the first time they have no idea. They just picked it up. They literally picked it up somewhere. They're just walking around in their life and they just pick it up and they just put it in their pocket and that's it. That's what they think now about a thing. And they have no clue now. 10 years have gone by, 20 years have gone by, and they've totally forgot where they got it. And that's the very beginning of them being like, well, maybe that's not good enough, actually. And then they can start to question themselves, and then you can start to present some facts. But they were just caught up by a wind of teaching, just this, and oh, that's it. I got it. That's a normie. Now we need to know how normies think. because that's the vast majority of people. It's the people who you could say who would say, "Oh, preserving democracy is the most important thing in this country." Don't even know what it means. Let me take a break. Okay, take a break. Come back. When you take normal people, a normie, that's different than normal people. John Nolte talks about normal people all the time. This is different. When you take a normie and you put them in bureaucracy, oh, well, now that's when you take a person who may be uninformed and they go absolutely brain dead. Great to talk to John Carney, Breitbart Economics Editor. John Carney, how you doing, sir?
Good morning. How are you?
Really good. You know, we talked to your brother the other day, and oh, did he give some dirt on you?
I do have to say, if you want more dirt, you can pick up his book, Family and Friendly.
He said you were mentioned. Wow. Has this caused a family riff in any way?
I am in the book because I live about a mile away from a baseball field that you cannot walk to with your kids, and you cannot send your kids to it because there's just too busy roads. We built America wrong in terms of our infrastructure. That's what Tim's book's about, Family Unfriendly. We need neighborhoods where people can just let their kids go outside and play. You say, you don't need the Xbox, you don't need your phone. Go outside, find your friends, come back when the streetlights go off.
So this is, we have a ton to talk about, so we'll just keep this one quick. But that is that issue right there, being anti-road, or something like that, you can define it better, is something that for a long time was a far left, weirdo, like hippie, environmentalist-y kind of thing that I would like to take over as a conservative, issue.
Yeah.
I like how you said it. We built it wrong.
It's the most pro-family position you can have, which is if we need Americans, we need people to have more people. Children are great, but we make it too hard if you have to drive your kids to everything. If you have to keep your eyes on your children all the time, you're actually programming the country to have fewer children. What you need is to say, let's get out there. And by the way, when the kids are out there playing on their own, they're actually training to be free people because they're developing a sense of independence. So that's what we need. Tim's book, Family and Friendly, tells us how to do it.
Yeah, very good. I have a lot more to say about that, but there's a lot of economic things. So we'll table some of that now. I got to ask you first about Donald Trump and Truth Social, which you're covering wonderfully on Breitbart.com. Is it true, John Carney, that for the last few weeks, all we've heard about is how Donald Trump is broke and bankrupt and Letitia James is going to have to confiscate his property because he's so broke. But what is really true is he's never been richer and he's on the Bloomberg Billionaires Index for the first time.
Yeah, Donald Trump has just come into a tremendous amount of wealth. He owns about 60% of the company that's called Trump Media and Technology Group. It merged with this SPAC. It's now trading publicly under the ticker DJT, Donald Trump's initials, obviously, and it has soared in value. It's more than doubled since the beginning of the year. It's up a tremendous amount just over the last couple of days since it started trading as DJT, and this has added, it has more than doubled Donald Trump's wealth. Is probably worth close to, it's a little hard to calculate these things, but probably close to $7 billion right now. This makes him not only one of the 500 richest, I think the last time I looked at the Bloomberg rich list, which is a long time ago, to be honest, but I think that puts him in the top 400. So he is becoming wealthier. Each day that the stock trades up, he makes a lot of money.
That's amazing. Now, my understanding is
he's driving them nuts. It's absolutely driving them left nuts. They are praying for this thing to fail. And I'll say, there will be up days and down days. Right now, we've had a series of up days, but stocks that go up 10 or 15% a day will also go down 10 or 15 or 20 or 30%. This will be a volatile stock. startups are risky investments. This is a brand new company. So there will be up days and down days. And when we have those down days, believe me, you will see headlines all over the establishment media saying,
oh, yes,
Trump loses $1 billion. They will gleefully celebrate this.
Oh, of course. Yes, of course. Now, my understanding is he can't sell any of these shares for like 6 months or something. But what is the Trump Media and Technology Group?
So this is what's interesting, is I think a lot of people are underestimating what it is. It is a brand new company. It's a startup. Right now, its main product is Truth Social, which is a more or less a Twitter clone, right? This, it was started when a lot of, before Elon Musk, bought Twitter and turned it into X. A lot of conservatives were getting forced off of Twitter or having their views suppressed so that, you know, you didn't get any responses. Nobody ever saw your comments on Twitter. So Truth Social existed. This merger with the publicly traded SPAC has given that company $300 million to invest in product. And what I think they are going to do is make it a lot more than a Twitter clone. It is going to become a new digital social media company. I imagine that they will have content, you know, like radio shows and podcasts, television type shows. I don't know if it will be, you know, on television, but, you know, visual and audio media, more social media innovation that will be aimed at an audience that is, frankly, tired of getting their digital media from places like Facebook, they could even go into things like AI. We saw the woke disaster of Google's AI. Well, what if we had an alternative to that? What if we didn't have to rely on, you know, the left-wing Silicon Valley types for our digital and social media, but we had a alternative? That's the plan for Trump Media, and that's one of the reasons why it's potentially worth a lot of money. Because there, you know, we've seen fragmentation in other forms of media. You know, we have Fox News and we have MSNBC. Well, that's coming for digital and social media as well. And that's what Trump Media is aiming to be a part of.
So there could be something there, you think? Because if it's just Truth Social, listen, a lot of these companies have never made any money at all, these big giant companies. Tech companies, and Truth is far away from, I think, whether they made like $4 million in revenue and they're costing like $40 million a year or something like that, but that's okay, that's fine. But I don't know, it's just it's like an echo chamber. I don't quite understand. I don't know how True Social could be worth billions of dollars. This is what I'm getting. It could be a thing that exists.
It's definitely not worth billions of dollars as it is right now, but the plan is to make it much bigger. When you look at what they're saying they're going to do, it is not, let's just, you know, be a sort of knockoff, you know, conservative version of other forms of, you know, of Twitter, or I forget what the various left-wing versions, you know, Mastodon, right? But let's not be that. Let's be something bigger, grander. And frankly, one of the reasons companies go public is to raise money so they have to invest it. This brought in nearly $300 million that they can now invest in growing new product, and I think that's what they're going to do. I'm not bothered by the losses at all. Twitter was losing hundreds of millions of dollars when it went public.
Yeah.
Amazon didn't make money for a decade after it was started. It had no profits for a decade. Yeah. And Reddit, which just went public recently, and is worth billions, has started in 2005 and has never made a profit. I think this company has the potential to make money and also a potential to be a much bigger force. But as you said, not if it's just going to be a Twitter knockoff. They're going to have to roll out new products.
I think the moral of the story right here is that there's no celebration of his net worth being higher than it's ever been. But the minute he loses a dollar, the left will be so gleeful.
It's going to be... the glee that you will read, you will see people, you know, Rachel Maddow will probably like pop a cork and celebrate. Donald Trump lost money. Hooray, hooray.
Yeah, that's right. All right, let's talk about the bridge collapsing. So what does this mean for the economy? Will there be, will we feel the economic impact of that?
Yeah, so a big part of whether how much we will feel it almost immediately. There are going to be scarcities and shortages. It will be hard to get things. Think back like to the pandemic when we had backup ports and you couldn't find things in stores and we were always surprised by what had suddenly disappeared. There will be instances like that, because the Port of Baltimore is a very important, very big port. A lot of imported cars come through there. A lot of imported farm machinery comes through there. But also just look, it is the fourth biggest port on the East Coast of the United States. A lot of that traffic can get directed elsewhere, but that creates traffic jams. You know, anytime you shut down a highway because there's an accident on a highway, people get diverted onto the other roads, but those other roads then get congested. That's what will happen to the ports. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how long is the Port of Baltimore going to be shut down? I've heard some people say it could just be a matter of days. We could clear it out and get the ships coming through there. I've also heard people say it could be months. I can see why it would take a long time. That bridge fell into the channel.
Yeah.
You need a safe and clear channel to bring those giant container ships through there. We have not yet begun to clear anything out because there are still corpses in the water. Mm-hmm. And so there, as long as we're still in recovery, we will not be in restoration of the channel. The channel will be able to be reopened. And that will help, there will still be delays in backup. Because anytime, it's just like when you clear a wrecked car off a road, it takes a long time for the traffic to get flowing normally. So we will have those supply chain problems. But we should be able to open the port relatively quickly. The bridge, on the other hand, is going to take a lot of time to reopen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that could be years before they put that up.
I think
properly.
It will take, I talked to Breitbart Business Digest, the daily newsletter. I have talked to people who said that it could take 5 to 7 years. As I've been doing my research, I think that is an underestimate of how long it is going to take. They're building a replacement bridge over the harbor in Corpus Christi, Texas. The construction began in 2016. It is not expected to be finished until next year. So, that's 9 years. This project could take even longer. And when we built this bridge back in the 1970s, completed it in 1977, it took 5 years. That was before we had, the demand that everything be done according to the requirements of diversity, inclusion, and equity. Mm-hmm. It was before we had all the environmental regulations. I mean, we're going to have people say, what about the Baltimore Bay snail or whatever how can you disturb its habitat? And so there will be obstacles there. And finally, there will be political obstacles. If Donald Trump wins the presidency, the left will not want him to cut the ribbon to reopen the bridge. I think they will do it. They'll do everything they can to prevent that from happening.
Well, we'll call it the Donald J. Trump Bridge. There's 10 ships that are stuck inside the port right now as well, which is an interesting variable. And we've had a bunch of people call. Like, first of all, have you talked yet to Oliver Lane, our London?
Of course. Oliver is a good friend and an expert in sea transportation, shipping, and bridges.
I love it. It's like unbelievable. Like, he wrote his postgraduate thesis on what happens if terrorists knock down bridges to block ports. It's like, oh, like, are you kidding me? Like, yes. That's unbelievable. Not that terrorists did this, but
place. We have almost a miraculous level of expertise. Whenever something happens, it's like, oh, hey, our guy in London wrote his thesis.
Yes. yeah, like something will happen, like, oh, Frances Martel, it turns out she actually, it's like, what do you mean? But we talked to him and some other people called in too, that this port in Baltimore has specific infrastructure to unload certain types of special things that cannot even be unloaded in Savannah, Georgia, or in New Jersey, which is pretty interesting.
It's very hard to unload cars you know, these big roll-on, roll-off farm equipment, you know, giant tractors, very hard to unload those. You need very specific things. And coal. This is a giant exporting port for coal. Coal is a hazardous material. You cannot just easily transport that to anywhere else. So there's specific things at this port. And it, while you can move that around, it takes time, and so yeah, it will be difficult.
No, it's going to be interesting.
And
to
by
see.
The way, those ships that are trapped there matter a lot too, because there aren't more. There's not excess capacity in global shipping. When you have these container ships trapped behind there, that is fewer ships traveling around the world to deliver things and pick things up.
Oh, you're
so
right.
That is another big problem.
Oh, that's right. It's not like they have a spare ship in the back.
No, there's no spare ships.
Oh, wow, interesting. Gosh, that's amazing. That is one interesting thing about capitalism, I guess. I don't know if we want to go all the way to capitalism. Or lately that we've, and we experienced this during COVID, that we have this like just on time, like max efficiency, yes, of delivery of things, which goes great until it doesn't. Is there any thought, or is any business being like, oh, maybe we won't do it this way anymore? Maybe we'll leave a little bit of buffer for us?
Frankly, I think so. One of the problems, the challenges of the global shipping business is that it tends to lose money. A lot of people don't realize this, but you'll notice that there's no real public companies that run these giant container ships. Why is that? It's because they lose money for 10 years in a row, and they only make money every now and then, and they try to make it all up. So like during the pandemic, it was very profitable to run the ships that were able to be run. It'll probably be profitable again right now if you have the ships that aren't trapped to be running the ships, because when there are constraints, they make money, but they don't make money most of the time. So again, they lose money 9 out of 10 years and try to make it all up in the 10th year.
Whoa.
So it's a very difficult business to be in. These ships are enormously expensive. It would be great if we could have some excess capacity in the system. I tried to look into it during the pandemic. It's really hard to do because it just takes so much. I mean, if you look at the size of the ship that crashed into the bridge in the Baltimore Harbor, these things are like small towns. Floating town.
Yeah, totally.
And you're moving these giant things, and they're very expensive to build, to maintain, to run, the amount of fuel that goes into them. So you really don't, you can't have, you know, an extra two sitting around. But they're also, by the way, like cars, right? Like the car that you parked in your backyard and you haven't driven for 10 years, I got news for you. It's not going anywhere. Same thing happens to your extra container ship. You can't leave it sitting anywhere for very long. Yeah. It needs to move. It needs to run in order to stay functional.
Okay. So this is actually a pretty good segue. We've got about 4 minutes because we want to get to the chair of the RNC. But you brought this giant ship, right? So Singaporean flagged, 22 crew members on it. I think they're from India. I may be wrong on that one. But I don't know if they're all from India or some from India. By the way, also the 8 construction crew that was on the bridge, that 6 of them are missing, 3 are from Mexico, 1's from Honduras, 2 from Guatemala, and another from El Salvador. So there's something there that's interesting as well. But we got a Singaporean ship, an Indian crew on it, and it's like what's happening with that? That's all something. And I tie that into your wonderful article you wrote, Breitbart Business Digest, Keeping U.S. Steel American is Not Protectionism. So a couple weeks ago, U.S. Steel is going to, or they plan to be bought by Nippon Steel, so a Japanese company. And that just rubs me the wrong way. And I feel like people instinctually that should rub people the wrong way. But academically, is it bad?
Yeah, it is bad. Look, these ships used to be American and British and Dutch ships, you know, that were run with American and British and Dutch sailors. They're not anymore. There's very few. And the reason is people have decided they want to go ultra cheap. So they're, you know, obviously when you crew them with people from the Philippines, the officers of the ships tend to be from India, then it's actually a lot cheaper than trying to hire people from, you know, the UK or the US. That's a big problem. And frankly, it's a subsidy to all the companies that are exporting their goods into the U.S. if we actually had some sensible regulations that required that ships coming into the U.S. be manned by Americans, it would be more expensive, but it would actually put foreign manufacturers on a more even footing. Because guess what? When you are shipping things around the U.S., when you are building things inside the U.S., you're hiring Americans. So you're giving an advantage to people when you say, yeah, you can ship your things with a crew full of foreigners into the U.S.
What would Milton
Friedman say? Set that on a level playing field. We could say, you know what? You got to put Americans on your ship. Half of them American.
I hear you talking now, and I want everyone to read this article. Keeping U.S. steel American is not protectionism. And I read this, and I think, what would Milton Friedman say to you, John?
I think he would agree with me, because he would say, look, free trade is great. It is not great if you are allowing other countries to victimize you. In other words, in my perfect world, I'm not sure that we would have high protectionist barriers. In my perfect world, we would compete on a level playing field, but we don't have that, and you will never have that as long as you let yourself be played for the sucker in the global trade game. You need to say to people, if you do practice mercantilism against us, we will put up barriers against you. Then guess what? They might not do it, and then you get to actually compete, you know, in a Milton Friedman capitalist way, rather than become victimized by their predatory policies.
So if not allowing the Japanese company to buy U.S. steel is not protectionism, would you say it's not? What is it?
So classic protectionism is when you have a company that's basically a monopoly in your own country, and you're protecting it from foreign competition. That's not what we were doing by saying you can't buy U.S. steel. We're not protecting anything. We're not building a fence around anything. We're saying you can't buy U.S. steel. You can, you know, still sell steel to whoever you want. This U.S. company is not, first of all, it's called U.S. Steel, but it's not a monopoly on steel. And so it's not protectionism. What it is saying that we think it matters as a matter of national security that certain industries be owned by Americans. Exactly why Nippon Steel wanted to buy U.S. Steel has not been clear to me. And the excuses that I've been told, oh, well, they're going to invest more money. We have plenty of capital here. If more money needs to be invested, we can do that. So that can't be the answer. The fact that I can't get a clear answer makes me worry that something nefarious is going on. Why do they want it? If, you know, what advantage do they see in buying it? If somebody could explain that to me more clearly, maybe I would be more open to it. But frankly, you cannot run, you know, a powerful country without controlling your own steel industry. America needs steel, and so we should, you know, we should make sure that it remains an American company as long as we can.
Yeah. You wrote in your article, there's some chemical or something, some mineral, gypsum. Gypsum is now, it gets imported a lot to the Port of Baltimore, which is used in fertilizer and cement. Like, that has national security implications. Gypsum, certainly steel would as well.
Absolutely.
That seems to be an even easier argument. John Carney, everyone, please go sign up for the Breitbart Business Digest newsletter. Give that a Google. And the first article you should read is this one about steel and protectionism. John Carney, great to talk to you, brother. I'm American made. I got American parts. Thanks for listening to Breitbart News Daily. We talk to John Nolte every Friday, 8 o'clock. So we'll wrap up the week with him as well. We got to do more talk on the normie and the idea of the normie. It's very, very important. And we should also begin our series on how to change someone's mind. Not how to win arguments, but how to change someone's mind, especially the normies who are being tossed to and fro. So we'll do that tomorrow. Mike Slater, Breitbart News Daily. Spread the word.